for inviting me to be here tonight. Actually, I'm not visiting. I'm coming back home. Ron and I both are old Capaya County boys. We grew up in Capaya County. My generations go back at least four generations in Capaya County in that area in Mississippi. So really, I'm just coming back home. As a matter of fact, I left North Louisiana this morning, headed this way at noon, actually, to come visit my mother. Today is her birthday, and we had a very pleasant old-timey country dinner in celebration of her birthday today in Capaya County. So really, I came back home, and this is home to me. My family and my roots are here, and my family go back to Georgia and South Carolina. I know my roots, and I know I'm a Southerner. I'm proud of that fact. I'm sure you are proud of that fact, and you wouldn't be here. I'm a son of Mississippi, not just necessarily a son of the South, but a son of Mississippi. I love the South, just like you love the South. But there's something unique about people like you and I. Unique because we're not ashamed to admit our love for our heritage and our people. There's something unique about us because we don't accept all that garbage that people jump out through the TV sets and the radio and certain written media that tells us that you should hang your head and be ashamed of being a Southerner, that Southerners were evil people for doing all those horrible things. You and I, we don't believe that. I love the South. I love the things that are unique about the South. I love the South. I love the fragrance of the South. Honeysuckle, magnolia, pine trees, cypress woods. I love the South. I love the warmth of the South. It embraces me like a mother's loving and tender care. I love the South. And I love the courage of the South. The courage that was demonstrated time and time again as those men, shoulder to shoulder in line of battle, faced an enemy that would make normal people quake in their boots. But our forefathers, they did not quake. They charged forward. They advanced against odds that normal human beings would never even consider to attack. But our people would not be defeated. Yes, I know that our battle flag and our army was, quote, defeated. But people, you and I have inherited a legacy and a history of a people who would not be defeated by defeat. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about those people who would not be defeated by defeat. The South has taught us many things as a people. The South has taught us how to love and respect life. It has also taught us how to love and respect the giver of life, God Almighty. That's the kind of South that you and I have inherited. That South that taught us to love life, to love God. But it also taught us that in this life that we love to be a part of, and I don't know of anybody on the face of the earth that enjoys living more than Southerners. If you don't think that's correct, you wait till deer season comes around. Try to find someone to do something. They're off in the woods having a good time. And any simple person be there with them, enjoying life. Not out chasing the almighty dollar as if the dollar was the only thing in the world worthy of pursuit. Now, I'm not saying that the pursuit of materialism is all bad. But people, there's more to living than gathering in materialism. It's living with this world that God has blessed us with. It's associating with our fellow human beings. It's learning to interact with the God of nature and his people. Southerners traditionally have always sought that type of life. That's why those Yankees just couldn't understand us. They couldn't understand a people who would put more interest in good hunting dogs than would good stocks and bonds. To me, I'd much rather have a good dog than a good piece of real estate that's on a piece of paper. But that's why those people could not. There was a cultural difference between Northerners and Southerners. This difference goes back much further than the so-called Civil War, which we all know was nothing less than the War for Southern Independence. This cultural difference goes a long way back. It goes back to our roots in Scotland and Ireland and Wales. Those people who came over here to the South were a unique type of people. Dr. Grady McWhinney, the professor of history at Texas Christian University in Dallas, Texas, has stated that the war for Southern independence was not nearly a war of brother against brother as it was a war of culture against culture. He's right. Our people, the Southern people, the people who inherited this part of the country, and those who inherited the colder clime of the North, colder in more ways than temperature, I may add, those people and our people were different. Have you ever wondered why General Robert E. Lee never referred to the Yankee as the enemy or the people, but as those people? That was his universal term for the Yankees, was those people. Because those people are not our people. One time I had a northern fellow that came down and said, you know, I didn't understand for a long time what you southerners meant when you asked me if I had any people around. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I was working here. He was from Michigan. I believe he said that every time someone asked him, do you have any people here? He said, I never heard that term before I came down south. It kind of struck me. I said, well, you know, that's right, because we southerners have an affinity for our people. But it's been like that for years and years and years. The experience, the Holocaust that we went through in the war for Southern independence only made us closer as a people. I love this South of ours. That's why one reason I wanted to write this book, and Ron and I wanted to write this book, The South Was Right. In actuality, I wanted to name the book originally To Live or Die for Dixie. Now, understand, a gentleman in Madison, I believe, Mississippi, has written a book. Well, what is his name, Carter? You might recall. He's up around Madison. But you know, he's written a book about one of the
38, maybe.
Yes. Powell has written a book, and it's entitled To Live or Die for Dixie. So I thought, well, hey, that's nice. Somebody got that title. But my brother said, no, let's state it as it is. Let's don't skirt the issue. Let's be up front with people. Let's put a big old Confederate flag on that book and title it The South Was Right. Said, in your heart, you know it's true. I said, you're right. Let's do it. In your heart, you know that the South was right. And that's what I want to talk about in the next few minutes. If I can see that old little bitty, why can't we get such a little bitty clock with such an old man? I'll try not to run over too much time here. But the next few minutes, I want to talk to you and explain to you why I feel that the South was right. What makes the South right? There are many reasons that I could rattle off this point, that point, minor points of constitutional law, of maybe logic and philosophy that would argue for the point that I believe the South was right. But really, I can distill it into two or three little points. And one of those is a belief. The Southern people traditionally have held a belief that government was an agent of the people. That we, the people, create government and give it authority. Now, we don't do this in some abstract fashion. We do this as people of God, under God's rule. That God, when he set us into the Garden of Eden, and then we rebelled against him, we left from his presence. But we were under his rule nevertheless. We did not escape from his law. But as a people, we had to form government in order to allow government to keep us from destroying each other's property, each other's rights, and trampling on each other's liberty. Thomas Jefferson said it very well, that great Southerner from Virginia, Jefferson, when he wrote in the Declaration of Independence that the only legitimate government that existed was that government which existed on the basis of the consent of the governed. The consent of the governed. Very interesting. If you'll go back, I was talking to Brother Calhoun here earlier about a book that I just got through at least reading portions of entitled Lex Brecht. And in that book, one of the things that the author is talking about was how a legitimate government derived its authority and power. And of course, it is from divine origin, really, because you and I as human beings, we don't possess authority. except that which is granted unto us or that we derive through God Almighty. But the original foundation upon which the republic and our country originally was a republic, it was a republic of republics. That may be saying curious to some people to say that, because I know we pledge allegiance to the flag, we say to the republic for which it stands. But people, a republic is a unique system of government. And back in the 1700s, when our forefathers were struggling or beginning to form our nation, as it were, republics were rare indeed. Republics just didn't exist. Today we take, quote, republics and democracy, a word that I don't like using, but we take these things for granted. But back then, authoritarian government, government by centralized authority, the king ruled. The king was almost an autocrat. He had all power. What little power that the parliament had was only begrudgingly given by the king to parliament, but essentially the king ruled. When our forefathers put a nation together here, they formed a republic, but it wasn't a republic of America. What was it? It was a republic of sovereign states. The state of South Carolina was just as free and sovereign as the state of Massachusetts. These states together, the people of those states formed those states, and those states formed the United States of America. Not the state of America, but the United, capital U, capital S, United States of America. And we became a constitutional republic within about 15 to 20 years there. Our people said that this government will have authority, only that authority that we, the people, acting through our agents, the state, will delegate to that government. That government rests upon a principle that we, driven by the impetus of our freedom, that we grant to government certain, we delegate to government certain powers. Does that exist today? If you think that government exists today on that premise, go tell the IRS you're not going to pay your income tax. What was a given back in 1776 has been turned upside down. Today, government dictates to you. Government tells you what to do, when to do, how much to do. Government has all authority. You must follow suit, or else you'll end up in their federal jail. We've allowed that system of government that our forefathers in 1776 established, we've allowed that to be turned upside down. But it was not always so. Our forefathers in 1861, just like our forefathers in 1776, they understood that American government was slipping away from its basic premise. The premise of free men driven by their freedom granting to government a certain delegated right. And our forefathers said, what you are doing in Washington, D.C., Mr. Abraham Lincoln, is that you're establishing another autocratic government in this world. You're forming a government that is just as vile and just as tyrannical as the one from which we seceded in 1776. So therefore, Mr. Lincoln, we are not going to allow you to do this to our people. We, the state, will wrap our protective arms around our people and we will withdraw. Listen to what Jefferson Davis said in his inaugural address as President of the Confederate States of America. And he said this in reference to the Confederacy seceding from the Union. He said, if this act, quote, it illustrates the American idea that government rests upon the consent of the governed, and that it is the right of the people to alter or abolish them at will whenever they become destructive to the ends for which they were established. That's the same thing, almost literally word for word, that Thomas Jefferson was saying in the Declaration of Independence when Thomas Jefferson announced to the world the independence of these colonies. He told the world that the tyrant in London, in this case, the king and parliament acting in conjunction with the king, were acting in such a way that the best interests of the people were no longer being served. Therefore, the people recalled their delegated rights. and establish another form of government that better suited them. That's in the Declaration. That's not Johnny or Roddy Kennedy talking. That's not some abstract idea that I gleaned from some musty old book. It's in the Declaration of Independence. I challenge you to read that document. Read it. You'll see what Jefferson said. Jefferson said that you are free. You deserve to be free. Part of your freedom is that you have the right to consent. If you have the right to consent, you also must have the right to unconsent. He said, you have the right to consent to the form of government that exercises authority over you because that government derives its power from you. Hey, what did Lincoln say? Lincoln said, hey, wait a minute, you states can't do that because we, the central government, we give you, the states, the power. And you act upon that power only as we allow you because we're the central government. What did Jefferson Davis and the Southern Patriots say? They said, no, sir, Mr. Lincoln, you're wrong again. Just like King George did not get power, did not grant us power, just like King George did not have the right to say that we could not withdraw from the British Empire, King Abraham, you neither have that right. That this right was a right given to us by God. No authority upon the face of the earth can undo that. Yes, tyrants have the power to suppress liberty. They do. Tyrants do that. Whether it's a Hussein, a Hitler, or Stalin, we all know that tyrants can suppress liberty. But people, tyrants can never destroy liberty. Get that in your head. If you get nothing else here tonight, remember, tyrants cannot destroy liberty. They can only suppress liberty. If you don't think that I'm proud of being a Southerner today, there's something wrong with you. There's no greater day to be a Southerner and alive since Appomattox than this very day. Why? Because, people, current events have finally caught up to Southern history. Think about it. Secession is breaking out all over the world. All those unions that were supposed to be perpetual and last forever are gone. Thank God. Our only problem is to make sure they don't reappear in a worse form. But people, today is the most exciting day to be a Southerner because we are vindicated. Our people are vindicated. The principle for which your forefathers, my forefathers from Mississippi, the principle for which we fought for have been vindicated. And oh, it's like dropping an earthworm on a hot plate when you watch these diplomats from Washington, D.C. squirm when somebody says, Mr. So-and-so, why is it that the government today is recognizing the secessionist province of Croatia and Yugoslavia, in what was former Yugoslavia, and up to now you've said secession was wrong? Before they start squirming. First thing they say, excuse me, I gotta go to the bathroom. Did you watch Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia? If they struggle from the tyrant, from that old union, they broke free from that old union. Did you watch them as they seceded one after the other? And did you watch the Republicans in Washington, D.C., same party as old A's party? You see them squirm when they start having to recognize the secession movement. Throughout the world, the whole world heard about the secession movement breaking out in the Boston. Oh, I tell you, the old line Republicans. Now, I'm a Republican. I'm a new line Republican. But the old line Republicans, they squirm. It's like taking an earthworm and dropping them on a hot plate. Fear. You can hear. My Lord, we've got to come to grips with this idea that secession might be right. Hey, if it's right in Lithuania, if it's right in Croatia, in Slovenia, in Latvia, if it is right for the republics of the former Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic to break away. If it's right for them, why in God's name was it not right for Dixie? Yeah. That's why they squirm. They know the South was right. They know it in their heart of hearts just as much as you and I know it, and it scares them literally to death. What are these crazy people going to do next? I don't know. I can only say praise God, let it come. People, we have a right to our freedom as Americans. And the greatest thrill I've had from writing this book, believe it or not, is the volume of mail and letters I get from up north. One third of all the mail order books that I've sold have been sold to people up north. And when I say up north, I mean anything beyond the Mason-Dixon or, you know, Texas or that area. Now, I'm one of these weird people that says if you're not a Southerner, you're a Yankee. You'll prove it otherwise, you know. Now, you may not believe that, that's fine with me, but that's just my prejudice. Now, I enjoy that prejudice, and I gave up a lot of prejudice in my life, and I ain't giving up that. That's gonna be fine. Alright. The thrill that I've given to get letters from these people, I've gotten hundreds of letters. I have yet to receive one letter from a person up north that didn't say, "Thank God you people down there are finally saying what you should have been saying all along, because we all need to hear." The people in New York, in the original Constitutional Republic, some of the strongest states' rights statements you'll ever want to read came from New York and Massachusetts. Talking about gun control? Now everybody says, "Well, Southerners hate gun control." Y'all read what Pennsylvania said about gun control. The people in Pennsylvania said that this was a right of the state, the federal government stay out of it. It said, as long as we, the people of Pennsylvania, have the right to control and have weapons to control in our own community and protect our own commonwealth, we don't have to fear the federal government. Go read the Anti-Federalist papers, what Pennsylvania was saying about that. Listen, this issue of states' rights, this issue of freedom, it's not a North-South issue anymore. It's an issue of people. I believe personally that we, the people of the South, that we will be the vanguard of a great movement that calls people back to our basic principles of constitutional liberty and freedom. We all know the oppressive yoke that has been laid upon us by a big government, a too big government, I may add. Our forefathers in 1776 rejected the British tyranny because of a little small tea tax. It's nothing compared to what we have to labor under today. The regulations that the British Parliament put upon our people is nothing as compared to that which we have to struggle under today. And that is because the idea of states' rights was overturned at Appomattox. What was furled at Appomattox was not just Confederate battle flags, but the principle of a constitutional republic, i.e. states' rights, division of power, a coordinate government. That's what our forefathers created, what is known as a coordinate government, a government of equal partners. The states had power, the central government was delegated by the states certain power, and they both were co-equal. But the state was the agent of the people. Here was the repository of individual liberty and freedom, states' rights. Unfortunately, the states' rights issue has been used and misused and abused many times, and it has a bad connotation in some places. But let me assure you that the proper recognition of states' rights is the greatest bulwark against the imposition of federal tyranny and the greatest guardian to civil liberties and civil rights known to man. I believe also the South was right because inherently the North is wrong. The North is wrong in several, in two key areas here, but the North has been wrong. And the interesting thing is the North was not wrong originally. It was only after a certain limit of time had passed in the original Constitutional Republic that certain elements, mainly industrial elements, and commercial elements up north realized that they could use the power of the federal government to enrich themselves. Of course, they enriched themselves at the expense of the South. I'll give you an example. Admiral Raphael Sims, in his book, Memoirs of Service Afloat, states that two-thirds of the revenue that was generated by the federal government in the years from 1840 to 1860 was generated from tariffs imposed in the South. Revenues were taken, two-thirds of it was taken out of the South. The bulk of that revenue was spent for internal, what many Southerners call infernal, improvements up north. railroads, harbor improvements, canals, all those things were disproportionately financed out of pockets of Southerners. So for this reason, many Southerners had said there's something wrong here, and that's why they went back and said we must do something about this. Now, two of the great things that I feel like the North really did a disservice to the South, and why I say the South was wrong, was in their treatment of the race issue. Today, unfortunately, we have been stigmatized as racist, as bigot, and as hate mongers. Today, if you wave a Confederate flag, you're automatically thought of as a Ku Klux. Well, I'm going to tell you something, folks. I'm not a racist. I'm not a Klux. I don't wear a white sheet. I wear a white hat. I'm a good guy. I don't like being portrayed as the media often would portray, the liberal establishment anyway in the media would portray me as a bigot because I'm proud of my Southern heritage. But this idea, this treatment of the race issue goes back a long way. It goes back to the days when the North had slavery. It was prominent in its society. Many people don't even realize that in the North, slavery was just as prominent as it was down South. As a matter of fact, I was talking to an individual about this one time. He said, "You mean to tell me they grew cotton up north?" No, that's not the fact. You have to look at slavery in the context in which it took place. It didn't take place in the 20th century or the 19th century. In New England, it took place back in the 1600s and 1700s. At that time, they needed labor to clear forests, to build bridges, to build forts, to build, make improvements, harbors, etc. They needed muscle power. They didn't have internal combustion engine factors. They didn't have tractors. They didn't have bulldozers. They had to use human muscle more than anything else. Where could they get that kind of power? They could not get it from the immigrants of Europe, but they could get it from Africa. The people in New England actually built the infrastructure of New England on the back of the black laboring class. In other words, as long as slavery was productive and good and needed in their society, it was okay. But then, once they had all the need for the black man that they could possibly utilize, then they got rid of the black man. But it's interesting to know why the Yankees would tell you, they'll beat their breast and wrap their cloak of self-righteousness around and say, "Oh, look at us, we're so good, righteous people. We got rid of that evil and vile system of slavery." I've heard it so many times I can literally puke every time I hear it. I'd be a real thin man if I did that, because I hear it a lot. But why did they get rid of slavery? Listen to what, I'm going to paraphrase. I didn't bring my direct quote, but I'm paraphrasing what John Adams said. You're familiar with John Adams, the Adams family of Massachusetts, not the one that made the movie about now, but the original Adams family of Massachusetts. It's as blue blood as you can get. John Adams stated that the sole reason that the people in Massachusetts, so therefore New England, got rid of slavery was because the white working class refused to compete against the black man. And John Adams goes on to say, moral scruples had nothing to do with the Northerners getting rid of slavery. The Northerners got rid of slavery because the Northern working people did not want to compete with the black slaves. And John Adams goes on to say, very enlightening here, he said that if the Northerners had not gotten rid of slavery, the white Northerners would have killed both slaves and slaveholders. Now, does that tell you anything about the attitude of the North when they wrapped their blanket or robe of self-righteousness around and look down their long pointy nose at the South and say, "Oh, but we got rid of that system. You should have done like us." Well, if we'd done like them, what we would have done was to free slaves through a gradual system of emancipation. What they would do to get rid of their slaves, they never, never, ever freed by law any slave that was alive at the time that law was passed. Did you know that? What they did was they said, "This slave woman here, after May 31st, 1802, every slave woman that has a child once that child has reached 21 or 23 years of age, that child then would be free. But that meant that old Carl here, who owned three or four slaves, his slaves remained him from that day forward, because they were never free. Now those children of old Carl's slaves, after they reached an age of 21 to 23, different states had different regulations, then they would be free, provided old Carl didn't take those slaves and sell them down fast. Look at the census figures in New York, in Massachusetts, in New England. Notice that from the time that the gradual emancipation of the black was begun until by 1840, there's a decrease, radical decrease in the percent of black population and the exact numbers, total numbers. What was happening was that old Carl got to keep his slaves forever until they died, so he did not lose anything. You know, the Yankee is nothing else. He is very profit-minded. So old Carl here, I hate picking on you, Carl. You're evil slaveholder Yankee. Old Carl got to keep the slaves that he already had, plus those that were born after that date. If he was of such a mind, he could take them down south and sell them down south, or he could even sell them in the Caribbean and Latin American areas. And that essentially is what happened. To give you an idea of how the people of Massachusetts felt about the black people in that area, they passed a law in 1794. It remained on the books until 1834. That's a rough quotation. I'll get you the exact figure. But in that neighborhood, they had a law on their books that stated any mulatto, black, or Indian that moved into the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for more than 2 weeks would be publicly flogged until that mulatto, Indian, or black left the Commonwealth. Now, if the first flogging didn't work, the flogging would be repeated until said Indian, mulatto, or black did leave. That here gives you some idea how they felt about black people and the race issue. But yet they condemn you and I, fellow Southerners, as being bigots. If I'm a bigot, they're a hypocrite. They're a hypocrite and a bigot. That makes them twice as bad as me. That gives you some idea of their idea of how they want to treat blacks in up there. Another thing they tell you is that down south, it was nothing but an evil, oppressive system of slavery, and everybody in the south was tainted by this vile system. Now, I'm not going to defend the system of slavery. I don't care if you. My people never owned slaves, so I don't feel obligated to defend it. But I'm going to tell you something. The system of slavery, as spoken of by the last living remnant of the slave system, and the system of slavery that is talked about in textbooks and on TV and the movies, is two different systems. If you'll ever go back and read any of the records of the slave narrative, you'll find out that the slave narrative was in somewhere between 1930 and 1940. The United States government sent throughout the South and some northern border states journalists who were out of work. It was a WPA project, workers' project. And these journalists were to go around and get narratives of the last remaining slaves, people who could still in their memory, they were some 70, 80, 90 years old, but in their memory they had some memory of slave days. When you go back and look at that narrative, you'll find anywhere from 50 to 80% of those who were, whose narrative was taken down, they say only good and positive things about the South, about their masters, and even about the system of slavery itself. Now, why is it that every time you turn the TV on and they've got a show on that depicts slavery, you'll see nothing but the total opposite? Well, the reason is simple. Because our conquering master has learned that he can use this issue of slavery and race to beat you down and make you sit upon that eternal stool of repentance. He's lying. He's lying. Certainly there were evil in the system of slavery. I don't doubt that. But there's also many good things. And the slave narrative totally refutes the Yankee mythology that all slaves in the South were treated horribly, and all Southerners were evil people for owning slaves. I challenge you at some time to look at that document. It will shock you. It did me. I was very impressed by what I read. But what about the South? Were there people, black people in the South, who loved the South? Were there black people who really was willing to defend and die for the South? People, I'm telling you, yes. Very much so. Let me tell you two stories about Confederate soldiers who were black. One of them was Levi Carnine. Levi Carnine was a slave from Mansfield, Indiana. His master went off to war in 1861. Levi went with his master. Levi went off to war with his master, went up to Virginia, from Mansfield, Louisiana, all the way up to Virginia. When he got up to Virginia, his master was killed. Levi took care of his master, and buried his body, all the personal effects, and that was sent back to Louisiana. And then Levi went to the colonel of the regiment and told him the situation. The colonel said, if you'll stay with me, I'll see to it that you get back when things calm down and we can get you back. They were in the middle of one of the early campaigns. So Levi served the colonel of the regiment for several months until the colonel got killed. Levi again buried his second master. Took care of all the personal effects, sent all the information back to the family. And then he went back, not to Louisiana, but back to the company of men that he came up to Virginia with, who were all from the Mansfield, Louisiana area. I believe they called themselves the DeSoto Rifles. Levi, in his official document, Levi said he stayed amongst the boys, being the fellow soldiers, Confederate soldiers. And he went into battle with them. He took care of them, and they were close friends. They lived together. They literally slept together. The most integrated military force on the face of the earth was the Confederate Army. Shocking, but it's true. They slept together. And when I'm sleeping, I don't want to embarrass you, but any of you reenactors, do you know what spooning is? This is when you only have maybe one or two blankets, about four or five men, and you sleep just snuggled up one against the other, because that's the only way you can stay warm, else you'll freeze to death. Can you imagine walking on there and look like an Oreo sitting out there, black and white, black and white? But that was the Confederate Army. That was the Confederate Army. That would have been anathema in the Yankee Army. Well, they would never, never thought of anything like that. Well, this is horrible. It just wasn't socially correct, you know what I mean? But these people lived together. They loved each other. They respected each other. So much respect did Levi and his fellow Confederate soldiers have for each other. After the Mississippi River failed, the Trans-Mississippi was cut off from Virginia. There was no mail going back and forth. For over a year, the young men could not get letters back to their family in Louisiana. The people in Louisiana could not get mail back to Virginia. The young Confederate soldier said, Levi, will you help us? Levi said, yes, I will. They said, well, Levi, this is how you're going to have to do it. We'll write letters. You put letters on your body. Just hide them in your coat and everything. We'll collect all the Yankee greenbacks that we can find. We'll give you the greenbacks. And then we want you to desert. Desert? He said, yes, because you can't go from Virginia to Louisiana unless you go up north first. So that's what Levi did. He took the Yankee money and the letter, and he deserted the, quote, end quote, the Confederate Army, went up north, said, I'm free now. And as soon as they said, hey, that's great, he took off. He was gone. He went west, hit the Mississippi River, went down the Mississippi River, and then up the Red River to Mansfield, Louisiana, and delivered those letters home. Levi became an instant hero in that part of the country. After the war was over, Levi was a member of the United Confederate Veterans. At his death, the entire group of the old soldier was left, marched in mass to the cemetery to bury Levi. But that's not what the story is. Because Levi and the Confederate soldiers said, Levi is one of us. We want Levi to be buried with us. But there was a problem there. You see, the rest of the guys were white. They were being buried in the white section of the Mansfield Cemetery. But Levi was too. So you see, color didn't matter then, because there was a bond of friendship, bond of love there that existed. Race didn't matter then, because those people stood together and fought a common foe together. Levi was one of them. They and Levi were the same. They were Confederate soldiers. You can go to Mansfield, Louisiana today in the white section of that cemetery, and you'll see that tombstone says Levi Carnine, C.S.S. Now that tells a story that we need to tell. Here in Mississippi, you've got a similar story. In 1890, the state legislature was trying to pass a bill to raise a monument here in Jackson, Mississippi, to the Confederate War Dead. There was some resentment or resistance to that effort. One young man who was the son of a Confederate veteran rose to the occasion and spoke against spending that money for the Confederate monument. Why? Well, he said, primarily because the state didn't have the money. Probably like we are now, we're broke. But nevertheless, he said, we need to spend that money in other places, although it is a worthy cause. There arose on that occasion a representative from Washington County, James F. Harris. James F. Harris was one of the last six black Republicans in the state legislature. He rose to the occasion and he defended the establishment of that monument to those Confederate soldiers. Oh, how I would have loved to have been there to have heard this black representative give that white guy down the road for not honoring his heritage. You never did. In his speech, he said, I too wore the grave, just like my master wore. And if that war had gone on to this day, we would have still been there fighting for the South. Now, how many times you've heard any liberals tell that story? You won't, but we got to tell. 2 days later, the last six Republicans there in the old legislature presented to the Speaker of the House, the Democratic Speaker of the House, a silver set. They presented him this silver set because they said that they had been treated so fairly and so graciously without any prejudice of color that they wanted to present this silver set to the Speaker of the House. The guy, the black representative from, I believe it was Barber County, that was making this presentation, he made a statement that I, speaking as the black, he said, I was born in Mississippi, but raised in the North. Associations there taught me that the white man of the South was the dire enemy of the Negro. Then he goes on to say, but receiving such warm, cordial, and unprejudiced relationship upon the floor of this house, I am convinced that you are our best friend. Now, people, we need to tell that story. There is no need to hate. Let the liberals spread the hate. Let the anti-South bashers, let them spread the hate. We have truth and virtue on our side. I don't know if you saw this. This is in the Monroe, Louisiana paper. I got it this morning. Did any of y'all see this? This is talking about, you got it here, okay. It's talking about the Confederate battle flag being removed from the flag in Georgia. And I know you've got the same problem here. But the two stories that I have just told you, really the three stories, but especially those two stories at the end that really affect you, the people of Mississippi, so dearly. We need to tell the world that the idea that the Confederate battle flag, that being a Southerner and being proud of our Southern heritage is somehow or another... He cut me off. That's all right, my wife does it all the time. But she'll kiss me when it's all over. I don't want to kiss you, Carl. We need to let the world know that being a Southerner and being proud of our Southern heritage is not being anti-anybody. That in America, there's room for everybody to stand up and be proud of who we are. That as members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, that we're not demanding that somebody else go hide their heritage. But by George, we're not going to stand for anybody shoving our heritage under the closet, under the rug, or in the closet. We're going to fight, tooth and toenail. Folks, what we need to do, we need to reestablish Fortress Dixie. There was a time when no one would dare make such a statement as these people had made. There was a time when no one would dare defame the South. right now we have people, even conservatives, God bless them, that will defame the staff at the drop of a hat because they don't know better. It's our job to teach them better, show them better. I don't recommend slapping around, but if things don't change, I might even try that once or twice. Tell them how big they are. But anyway, we need to show them the where they are wrong and the correctness of our cause. We need to reestablish Fortress Dixie. After the war, after Reconstruction was finally won and over, no one would dare attack the Confederate heritage. No one. But now, it's fair game. It's politically correct. People, we have got to start doing something different. Obviously, we've done something wrong. It's time to start doing something right. Let's not join organizations. Let's not promote people in organizations now just because they're good people and we've known them a long while and they're good old boys. Let's start demanding of our organization and our leadership action. Show me what is your plan, Mr. Commander-in-Chief candidate of the SCV or MOSV or Lieutenant Commander or whatever they're running for. Show me what you are planning on to do about this. This is not a Georgia issue, folks. This is a Mississippi issue. Because if this flag goes in Georgia, how long do you think Mississippi's going to stand? Let's don't get so hung up on states' rights that we're going to sit here and say, oh, well, let the people in Georgia fight. That's their battle. No, it's our battle. It's our battle. It's our heritage. It's our cause. Well, I would be willing to venture that 20% of the people in Mississippi today have ancestors from Georgia. That's your fight. It's our fight. All of it. My people came from Georgia and South Carolina. I know. Let's demand of the SCV, of the MOSB, of the leadership, let's demand that they show us what are your plans. Don't tell me that you've been elected this office and that office and you've served so honorably so long. Just don't settle for that anymore. We want action. We want plans. We want a track record of action. And for God's sake, don't spend all your time suing your own people. You know, I don't know how y'all feel about it, and I'm not going to mention any names, and I'm not going to get off on a tangent. I promise. But I'm going to tell you something. Nothing aggravates me more than to see attacks like this being leveled against my heritage, and the National SCV do nothing. They might whine every now and then, but that's it. Now, if they got time to sue their own members, I think they ought to have time to attack the enemy. That's what we're here for. I'm not here to win converts to Donnyism. I'm here defending the cause just like you are. Let's demand of our organization, let's demand of ourselves, action. Let's rebuild Fortress Dixie, and we'll only do it one brick at a time. Don't think that you're going to go out by yourself and reestablish Fortress Dixie. You can't do it. I can't do it. 100 people can't do it. But I tell you what, each of us, doing their own thing, what you do best, or even if you can't do it best, just doing something. We will reestablish Fortress Dixie. We will establish a bulwark behind which our liberty, our freedom, and our heritage will be safe once again. But we've got to do it. This is not even a bridge. This is just a means whereby I hope that some of you can grab bricks and put them together. You know, every now and then you might have to throw a brick to somebody, I don't know. Somebody told me that this book wasn't good because it wasn't big enough. I said, what do you mean? He said, I've got some people that even when they read it, they don't understand, so I just want to hit them with it. I said, well, I've got a bigger book coming. So this is not a brick. I wish it was. But what this is ammunition for your rifle and your pistol. It's ammunition that you can use against the enemy. I invite each of you to enlist with fellow Southerners across the South and across America. And people, I've got letters from Spain, from Japan, from Holland, Scotland, from Ireland, just many different countries. People who said, hey, I like the ideas that you're talking about. I said, it's not my idea. I thought, I can't take any credit for that because it's surgery. search it, you will not find an original thought in that book. It's not one there. All I'm doing, all Ron is doing, all we're doing is taking what our forefathers, what your forefathers just said, and just put in here for you to grab and use against the enemy in defense of our liberty and our heritage and our pride. I invite you to grab these books. And this is not the only, there are many fine books. I really am a great fan of Mr. Calhoun back there, because he's got some books that, I'm going to tell you something, they're not books, they're dynamite. Those are the books that we need. Get them in your libraries. Get them in your public schools. Wherever you can put them, put them. His books, my books, but you know the type of books we're talking about. I don't want to see an SEV unit again buy some namby-pamby dishwater weak book that says, oh, well, we lost the war, we're one big happy nation now, ain't it good? No, it ain't good. If it was good, I wouldn't be here. If it had been great, I wouldn't have had to write that book, and you wouldn't have to be sitting here. There's a problem in America. The problem goes to our very soul. We need to change from the inside out. Get that change. Make that change. And then work together and let's change the South. The grand, the glorious, the everlasting South. Thank you.
We're going to take a few minutes here, and let's, whatever questions have been raised, let's just, everybody relax here, and let's begin now with a question and answer session.
I want to make an announcement. If supposed people leave, we back on the table, we have the four-page letter that the Kennedy boys sent out recently about doing something about it. So that's just an announcement. If anybody's got to leave, it's on this table over there. Get yourself.
Yeah, we have lots of materials back there, but do get that. All right, any questions now? Yes, sir.
With all of the researching and work, background work that you've had to do, there's bound to be a little insight in the book, how it's not there. What do you envision down the road, 5 years, 10 years?
For the South? For me personally, I mean as a group or a what? For us, all right, fellowship. So what I anticipate and what I am praying for is a grassroots revival throughout the South, a resurrection of that spirit of I'm proud to be a Southerner, and an investigation into why am I a Southerner. Once we get to that point, we're halfway home. Why does the enemy always have you read Frank Lawrence Osley's famous quotation? I think we quoted in the book that after the war, that the North literally set the South upon the eternal stool of repentance. You notice that? The eternal stool, that's what Frank Lawrence Osley said. Why did they put us there? So as long as we were repentant, as long as we were tongue-headed and ashamed of being Southerners, we would never again challenge their form of government, the centralistic form of government. So I envision, and I pray, that the day will come, and I believe it's going to start in Dixie and spread across this nation, that people are going to start saying, hey, this republic that we have now is nothing compared to the original constitutional republic, and start a demand for a return to that type of government. I know people, when I say that, they say, oh, well, that can't happen. People, who told you 5 years ago or 10 years ago that the Berlin Wall would come down? If somebody told you 5 or 10 years ago that Soviet Union would no longer exist, that the Union would dissolve and the Baltics would cease to be independent, you wouldn't have believed them. People, 5 years can be a lifetime. That's what I envision, and I'm praying for. Join me in that prayer.